Just a note or two before we get into the study. My personal public appreciation to you, Randy, for providing this facility. This is a wonderful place. It's the first time I've been here, and I've certainly enjoyed the meals and the association with all these young men. I'm glad that there are older preachers here that I can go to when I have problems. Unlike some here. I'll maybe make some personal remarks if that's necessary at the discussion hour. I think we'll just go right ahead and get into the study of the sponsoring churches is the theme for this hour. But I want to make one note, or a couple of notes. I want to thank Brother Wolfgang for this historical background. Some of us have done considerable study in the restoration movement, but not like he has. And it's great to have somebody who has much more minute understanding of this movement than the general principles that I've learned through the years in studying and teaching classes on the restoration movement. And I appreciate the work that he did. And I want to say just a word about Dan King's lecture. It's going to be some tough sledding for you guys to read that, but you got to do it. And you've got to master that chapter. That's every one of these speakers keep coming back to this matter of authority, and I'm fixing to do the same thing. And if you can get down that chapter, if you can get through it. there's some tough reading there, but you've got to work your way through it. I know years ago I got involved in some studies on the social gospel and had to go back and read some stuff by rationalists and working up to the 1880s and so forth, and read Machen's Liberalism, Christianity and Liberalism, some of that, and there's some tough reading there, but work on it, study it. You've got to get that concept of authority, and I'm going to emphasize a little bit of that in my lecture, but that's very important. But let me begin by saying, I've got some shadows here, I'm going to move over just a little bit. Let me begin by saying that much of what we are going to say here and have already said in this series of study is going to be unfamiliar to people that have no concept of the restoration movement. They have no concept of its validity. They have no concept of its controversies. They have no concept of some of the terminology that has been employed to deal with certain issues when you're talking about restoring the first century church. And so when we talk about sponsoring church in just a moment, that's going to be some unfamiliar language to a lot of folks who don't have any idea of what restoring the first century church is about. And furthermore, I would say to you that a lot of the stuff that we're saying here will really seem trivial to people who have an agenda that has no interest at all in getting back to the practices of the first century church. And so some of the language and terminology is just, to them, these are kind of silly, trivial discussions that we're having here this week. But when you recognize the soundness of the principle that we speak where the Bible speaks, and we're silent where the Bible is silent, when you grasp the truthfulness of that, when you grasp the scripturalness of that, then everything that we say is going to be really meaningful to you. And there's very few places that I go anymore that I don't have a sermon or preach a sermon on the silence of the scriptures. And we have to get that concept down. Nothing authorizes nothing. And if God says nothing, nothing is authorized. And the only thing that authorizes us to even be here or to baptize somebody is what God has said. And you've got to understand that principle, and you've got to get it down. Now, brethren who have moved on to higher and nobler principles of spirituality, and I speak facetiously there, but they'll scoff They would scoff at the idea and laugh at the idea of talking about sponsoring churches, talking about institutionalism. To them, this is pretty narrow. It's traditional. It's ritualistic. And as I said, it's trivial. It's unimportant. It's insignificant. And frankly, it's just denominational Church of Christ doctrine. And what I've heard some of you fellows say about these blogs, I think that's borne out. That these fellows are really scoffing and think what we're talking about is silly stuff. And so I make no apology at all for talking about these issues and talking specifically in this lecture about the sponsoring church. Because I believe the nature and I believe the character of the first century church, the church that Jesus built, including its organization and all of that, I think that all of this is significant, its mission, and I make no apology for it here, and I'm glad these men feel the same way. But discussing gymnasiums, discussing ball teams, discussing human institutions, sponsoring churches, these are not minor issues. These are all related to biblical principles that are taught with regard to the Lord's church. And so, after 200 years of efforts to restore the first century church, brethren have learned, and Steve, I thought, brought that out very well, brethren have learned that once you reject the organization of the first century church or the work or mission of the first century church, it doesn't stop there. It goes on to every phase. It goes on to the, quote, plan of salvation. Goes on to moral issues. Look at the disciples of Christ today. They're back homosexual marriages. And it just shows you to the extent that there's just endless rejection of New Testament teaching when you reject these fundamentals with regard to the very character and nature of the first century church. And so these aren't trivial issues. They're important to anybody who, again, accepts the principle that we speak where the Bible speaks and we're silent where the Bible is silent. Now, with regard to sponsoring churches, let me say, by way of introduction, a little bit of historical perspective here, that few issues have created division among brethren in every generation, few issues as much as the independence and autonomy of local churches. That's been a constant problem from the very beginning, as Brother Earnhardt talked about the second century. Now, I recognize that zealous and good-intentioned brethren have been involved in trying to bind congregations together, whether loosely or tightly. They've had good intentions, and I'm sure in many cases are zealous for the Lord and all of that. But this matter of the independence and autonomy of local churches has always been a problem. Brother Earnhardt referred to Ignatius, who himself, within just a few years after the death of the Apostle John, was the bishop of the church at Antioch. And he wrote to other churches and he said, you ought to obey the bishop of these churches as though he were Jesus Christ. And you ought to obey the elders of the church as though they were the apostles. And so already they had a bishop over elders, if these epistles are dated correctly, at 110, or I thought Brother Earnhardt said he died in 107, but I've seen dates of 110 to 117 as the dates of these epistles. So you're talking just 10, 15 years maybe after the Apostle John died that we've got these monarchical bishops. And then Williston Walker will tell you by 150, we've got metropolitan bishops. We've got one bishop in these cities that's over all the other monarchical bishops. And then, of course, to the patriarchs and the pope and all that. Now, the Reformation was concerned about that issue of organization, but it really didn't take hold in the minds of men until the time of the Restoration Movement. And in the Restoration Movement, men got very serious about this matter of the independence and the separateness of local congregations. Now, Thomas Campbell came to this country in about 1807 and was trying to preach just in the Presbyterian church, and he couldn't do it because they were so splintered and so divided. And he became very concerned about unity. And he finally came to the conclusion that the unity of whether his Presbyterian church or all churches or whatever is only going to come through a restoration of the first century church. And he says, we've got to get rid of all the rubbish of the ages, referring to the traditions of men, and we've got to find a thus saith the Lord for every belief and practice if we're going to have unity. And so it was in the summer of 1809 when he was preaching in the home of Abraham Alters that he was talking about this unity, and he was talking about this restoration of the first century church. And he said, brethren, this is not going to happen unless we learn to speak where the Bible speaks and be silent where the Bible is silent. And that little motto or slogan, biblical as it is, that became the slogan, if you want to use that expression, of the restoration movement. And so his son sort of took that theme, took that idea, and began to develop it in his first paper, The Christian Baptist, where he wrote a series of 32 articles on the search for the ancient order of things. And in those articles, Campbell was very hard on the clergy. It was kind of an iconoclastic type paper in which he was fighting the clergy, the pretensions of the clergy. He was fighting creeds as standards of authority and orthodoxy. And he was fighting unauthorized organization of the churches. This quotation in one of his articles. The church is robbed of its character by every institution, merely human, that would ape its excellence and substitute itself in its place. Now, this Campbell writing in the Christian Baptist from 1825 to 1830, and actually started the Millennial Harbinger before he ended the Christian Baptist. But what Campbell had seen from about 1827 on was the, quote, new evangelism of Walter Scott. And through the evangelism of Walter Scott, they were converting people by the dozens and by the hundreds, and he saw this movement growing. And just in a period of 3 years, he got enamored by the growth of this restoration movement and started the Millennial Harbinger with the idea of advancing Christianity throughout the world. And it's almost mind-boggling the suddenness with which Alexander Campbell changes his approach to this idea of the organization of the church. And Campbell stressed that the church, now we're talking shortly after 1830 when he began the Millennial Harbinger. And he stressed that the church can do what an individual cannot do. And a district of churches can do what a single congregation cannot do. And so out of this, over a period of 20 years nearly, grew and developed the thinking of Alexander Campbell in the American Christian Missionary Society, established in 1849. Now, from the beginning, men like Jacob Creek, various congregations throughout the Restoration movement and so forth, opposed the American Christian Missionary Society. And we need to grasp the fact that from the very beginning, there were men that were opposed to this, although it obviously became the dominant point of view. But when men opposed the American Christian Missionary Society, they didn't totally leave this concept of how are we going to cause this church to grow? How are we going to reach the world with this idea of restoration? And so they came up with the idea of a sponsoring church. Well, what we can do is not establish an institution, not establish an organization. What we can do is work through the elders. And so soon after the Civil War, they developed what is referred to by David Lipsman as the Texas Plan. And the Texas Plan, a church in Dallas, Texas, said, well, what we'll do is have churches send money to us. And then we'll send preachers out here, and that's the way we will organize this church and get it on the move and get it growing. Because, as Campbell would say, a district of churches or a cooperation of churches in an area can do what a church can't do. I mean, that's the reasoning and that's the thinking behind a lot of that. And then, of course, by 1900, 1910 or so forth, the Henderson Plan, where in Henderson, Tennessee, the college church there decided it would become a sponsoring church for West Tennessee. We're going to reach West Tennessee. And so churches send money to us, and our elders will send men out, and we'll evangelize West Tennessee. And then they moved into to citywide movements in the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, Tennessee, where N.B. Hardeman did all that series of sermons that you can, I guess most of those are still available in book form. But they had citywide movements in which a local eldership would sponsor the work in Nashville, Tennessee, and N.B. Hardeman would come and speak and preach what we call the Hardeman Tabernacle Sermons. That went on. Then, of course, obviously, Foy Wallace in the music hall meetings in Houston, Texas. Many of you probably have read, if you haven't, you need to, God's Prophetic Word, a series of lectures he did, or Bulwarks of the Faith, a series he did, I think, the year after, the year before, forgot the order of that. But anyway, those again were local congregations or elders having churches funnel money through them to evangelize that particular city and so on. Then eventually, of course, by 1952, the Herald of Truth was taken over by the Highland Avenue, Highland Street, whatever it is, in Abilene. The elders there took the oversight of that, and churches all over the country sent funds to them to produce the Herald of Truth broadcast. Now, all of those are, and again, terminology that came to be used, all of those are what we call sponsoring churches. In other words, a particular church, rather than a human institution separate from the churches, a particular church under the oversight of its elders would receive funds, oversee, and sponsor for all the various congregations this particular work of evangelism. Now, again, as I said earlier, all of these arrangements were opposed. There were none of them that went unopposed. There was never any universal agreement with regard to a missionary society or a sponsoring church. And of course, then by the middle of the 20th century, benevolent societies were also being supported, as has been noted earlier, under the oversight of elders. There were some of these institutions, as was noted, were under human organizations because, as Brother Woods and various ones would say, this is the work of the home. The elders don't have any right to oversee a home. And so this, and we can send money to a home as a church, and so therefore we can send it to this institution. I'm not getting into institutionalism, but I'm saying that was the concept of the benevolent institutions under the oversight, as I think Brother Sutton said, of an institution, an organization. And the organization was something totally separate. In fact, the men that ran those institutions, some of them didn't live within 100 miles of the orphan homes, and they were just an organization through which the churches could function. But then others said, no, this is the work of the church, therefore it has to be under an eldership. So you have the sponsoring church with regard to evangelism, and you have the sponsoring church with regard to benevolence. And a key point we will make with regard to that in just a moment, it's important to understand the distinction between evangelism and benevolence. And what we'll be dealing with here in a moment is the fact that churches sent to churches in benevolence, but we have no example where a church sent to another church in evangelism. And that raises an interesting question that we will try to deal with as we deal with this issue of the sponsoring churches. But First thing I'd like to do, and this is elementary, Mr. Watson, but I do want to talk a little bit about the organization of the church. I think it's important for us to understand a point or two about that in establishing this idea of independence and autonomy. We have to understand that in order to deal with this issue. Now, sponsoring churches must be studied then against the backdrop of the organization of the first century church. And so we start from the very first reference in Acts 14, verse 23, when Paul returned to some of the churches that he had established, he appointed elders in every church. Now, you move on forward to Acts 20, and to those elders at the church at Ephesus, take heed to yourselves and unto the flock, over which the Holy Spirit had made you bishops to feed the church of the Lord, which he purchased with his own blood. So those elders in every church were bishops or overseers, and they were shepherds who were to tend the flock. Now remember, elders in every church tend the flock of God. Now we move one step further in 1 Peter 5, where Peter, a fellow elder, writing to other elders, said, tend the flock of God which is among you. And we then go back and understand that every congregation had elders or had bishops. And so the flock among them was the flock over which they were shepherds or over which they were bishops in which they had been appointed elders. And so tend the flock of God which is among you, exercising the oversight, not for by constraint or not for filthy lucre, but being examples and so forth. Thus elders, as a father would lead his home, and that's one of the comparisons or illustrations that are used in the qualifications. As a father would lead his home, the elders are to lead the church. And in some respects, although the Bible doesn't deal with that principle, but as a father's over his house and another father's over his house, so these elders are over the flock then in which they've been appointed. So when we talk about the local church, let's understand that organization and a few points to make. Every local church is independent of others. And the elders of that church have no oversight over another body of believers, including its members and its work. Can't just limit and say, well, they're not over the members, but they can be over the work. No, every eldership, every local church is independent, and elders have no oversight over any congregation other than the one in which they're appointed. Secondly, every local church is autonomous under its elders, meaning it is self-governing by its elders under the authority of Jesus, who is the head of the church. And so under the authority of Christ, every eldership then is autonomous in that they are the leaders, and the Bible uses the word rule, and I know there's some controversy about that and all of that, and we need to, certainly that's a different issue, but they're over that congregation, and those members are to submit to them as their leaders in the congregation. And so each of those local churches has its own setup where they are autonomously controlled. No eldership. Thirdly, no eldership has authority to become an agency or a medium of oversight through which the other churches complete the work that God has assigned every local church equally. And that's an important point to recognize, is that every local congregation is equally and mutually obligated by the Lord to do certain works, and only the elders of that congregation can oversee that work. And so these are some principles that we'll deal with in a moment. But how could any arrangement, now think about this, how could any arrangement of these churches under the oversight of one of them, in other words, several of these churches under the oversight of one of these eldership, how could that avoid violating tending the flock of God which is among you? If you've got the work or the membership, whatever way you want to look at it, under the authority, or I don't like that word authority, but under the oversight of this eldership, how does that not violate this eldership overseeing somebody of another flock or some work of another flock. And so it violates the independence and autonomy of the local churches. So I wanted to start with that premise. Now, we need to move into a discussion of examples in benevolence, examples in evangelism, and to see what principles we can kind of thread out of all of this. Let's begin with Acts, the 11th chapter, that was referred to, I believe, by Brother Sutton in his remarks. But let's go to Acts, the 11th chapter, for just a moment. And in Acts 11, it says, "Now in these days there came down prophets from Jerusalem unto Antioch, and there stood up one of them named Agabus, and signified by the Spirit that there should be a great famine over all the world, which came to pass in the days of Claudius. And the disciples, every man according to his ability, determined to send relief unto the brethren that dwelt in Judea, which they did, sending it to the elders by the hand of Barnabas and Saul." So what we have clearly here, as Brother Sutton pointed out, is that you have a local congregation in Antioch determining, obviously, as they have that right to do, but determining to send relief down to the saints in Judea, and doing so by sending it to the hands of the elders, which makes sense since they're the overseers of the flock. Now, that's a clear biblical principle and biblical example. And some say, well, why does that not violate the independence and the autonomy of that church? If you can send funds to a church for benevolence, then why can't you send funds to one that's doing evangelism? And we want to get into that distinction in just a moment. But I want us to understand something that's different with regard to benevolence and evangelism. I don't like getting this idea explaining why God didn't do something. But when you got brethren saying, well, now you can send funds to a church for benevolence, so evangelism is another work of the church, therefore you can send funds to a church for evangelism. Well, I get back to the principle that we don't have any example of sending funds to a church for evangelism. Just stop right there. There's no authority for it. But brethren want some kind of an explanation. Well, there's got to be some explanation. Well, whether God gave us an explanation or not, there is a difference. I want to note that in just a moment. But before we do that, I want to go to, how'd that thing come? Oh, okay. I want to go to 2 Corinthians for just a moment now in this connection. And in 2 Corinthians 8, Paul says something that's very fundamental for us to grasp. And you can see it written in red on the chart there. But in 2 Corinthians 8 chapter, he says, "But now complete the doing also, that as there was the readiness to will, so there may be the completion also out of your ability. For if the readiness is there, it is acceptable according as any man hath, not according as he hath not. For I say not this, that others may ease and you be distressed, but by equality." Now get this verse here. "But by equality, your abundance being a supply at this present time for their want." That's the red part I want you to see. And then he reverses that and says that their abundance also may become a supply for your want, that there may be equality. So his point on equality is these brethren have need, and you, churches of Galatia, Corinth, those in Macedonia who want to give, send money down there because that's their need. That's their want. Now, if the situation is reversed and you're in want, then they can send up to meet your need. And so understand then, as you're dealing with benevolence and you send funds to a church that has a need among its members, over which its elders are overseers, that you're not that they're not sponsoring the work for you. Those elders are overseeing their work that God gave them to do. And while your work is to supply their need, their want at this time, it's their work to oversee, and they're not sponsoring this work for you. This is their work, this is their need. And so, Paul and Barnabas, now I want to go back to Acts 11. Now, some brethren have tried to get around this idea, this concept here in Acts 11. You'll notice in Acts 12, 25, that after Paul and Barnabas took the funds down there, Acts 12, 25 says they left Jerusalem to go back to Antioch. Now, what some brethren have argued here is that Paul and Barnabas just went to Jerusalem and gave it to the elders there, and they went out and took care of all the needs of the churches in Judea. Well, obviously, Acts 11 doesn't say that. So the fact that they left from Jerusalem to go home is a leap of logic to say that that's the only place they went. They may have visited all the churches of Judea and then went to Jerusalem and left from there. They could have gone to Jerusalem to see the elders there and helped them out, went to the other churches in Judea, and then came back to see the elders and gone. There's a lot of situation there, but we don't have any evidence. And again, we're back to the signs of the Scripture. There is no evidence that they took that money to the Jerusalem elders and the elders oversaw all these churches in Judea. Now, that would become a violation because of the elders in Judea and these Judean churches. That's their work, and not the elders at Jerusalem to oversee. But that's one of the arguments that's been made. And then a second one, which is a little hard to believe, and I read this several times to see if that really is the case, but a capable man like G.C. Brewer, and if you don't think he's capable, ask him. Read 40 years on the firing line, you'll understand what I was talking about. But G.C. Brewer had a little bit of an ego about him, but G.C. Brewer made the argument that the money, according to Paul in 1 Corinthians 16, was sent to the Jerusalem saints, and those elders went down and took care of Judea. The only problem with that is 1 Corinthians 16 is 10 or 15 years later than Acts 11. So why that argument got out there, I don't know, but when I was debating on this issue with Greg Gwynn, helped me on a debate on this issue, we called it the Brewer blunder, but that's obviously no example of a sponsoring church. So in the case of benevolence, we then do not have any example, any authority in that area for a sponsoring church. Now, we need to look at benevolence in comparison to evangelism. Let's move one chart forward here if we can, let's talk about evangelism for just a moment. Now, in the case of evangelism, and I might add that as we've already mentioned, there are sponsoring churches in the field of benevolence. When you do send money to an eldership and then you send your saints or your want down to them, then obviously you've got a church that is sponsoring the work for all the churches because everybody's sending their needy to that particular church or facility that they've set up. And that becomes a sponsoring church in benevolence. But when you send funds from one or many churches to a church to take care of its own saints, there's no sponsorship involved there. They're simply doing their own work. Now, if you send all your needy down there and they build a facility and everybody sends, then you have a sponsoring church like you do in evangelism. But I want to move to evangelism, and there's a distinction there, obviously, between a local work in benevolence in the previous chart and a brotherhood benevolent work that's done under the oversight of a single eldership. But what I want to talk to you about on evangelism We have no examples. And we're going to talk about cooperating in evangelism. The Bible teaches cooperation in evangelism. We're going to see that in a moment. But it doesn't teach cooperation evangelism of many churches sending to another church. But the principle of evangelism is that every local congregation is responsible for evangelism. And God has placed no boundaries. God has placed no limit on a local church. If you have the capacity and want to send 10 men out into the world to preach, fine, wonderful thing. And a lot of congregations are doing that. But what I want us to grasp is that evangelism of the world is the equal and mutual responsibility of every church. It hasn't been limited to any particular church. In benevolence, it's not the equal and mutual responsibility of Church A over here to oversee and take care of saints in Church B. That's their local work. Now, here in evangelism, God has placed no boundaries. And churches sent Paul down to Berea. They sent Paul over to Thessalonica. While he was in Macedonia, the Philippian church supported him. And as we'll see in just a moment, when he was down at Corinth, he robbed many churches, were supporting him in the work that he was doing here. But in the case of evangelism, it's the mutual, equal responsibility of all churches. Now, here's what we don't have authority for. We don't have authority for one church stepping in the middle there and saying, now you send funds to us and we'll sponsor these men. Lubbock, we'll take care of Germany. I've forgotten which church took care of Italy, but there were different churches who were sponsoring evangelism in these foreign countries. And other churches were sending funds to them, and then they were sending men and determining their support, just like a missionary society, except it was done under the oversight of the elders. And so we have churches in the case of Germany or Italy or whatever, we have them stepping in the middle. Rather than each church sending out its men, they're stepping in the middle and they're saying, we'll sponsor this work for you. Now, that's the question we have. Where is the authority for that? And the Bible is silent on any principle like that at all. Now, what I want us to do in our remaining time, what have we got, 10 minutes? 12 minutes, okay. What I want to do in the remaining time is talk about evangelism and cooperation in evangelism. And in the case of evangelism, we have the church cooperating, churches rather, cooperating through Paul. In 2 Corinthians 11 chapter, notice, if you will, verses 8 and 9, I robbed other churches, taking wages of them that I might minister unto you. And when I was present with you and was in want, I was not a burden on any man, for the brethren, when they came from Macedonia, supplied the measure of my want. And he says, in everything I kept myself from being a burdensome unto you, and I will keep myself. Now, I want you to notice a few things that that text says. Number one, the text says that Paul, not the church at Corinth, that Paul robbed other churches taking wages of them. Paul took the wages from these churches. The church at Corinth did not. Two, Paul says, it was my want. Just as in benevolence, it was the want of the Jerusalem church, their want. And if it would be reversed, it'd be your want in Corinth or other places. But notice here that Paul says that these wages that I received are for my want. This wasn't for the church at Corinth. And so the money wasn't sent to the church at Corinth. The money was sent to Paul and Guy and Woods. Back when he was opposing the missionary society, said the brethren simply raised money, sent it directly to Paul. This is the way it should be done today. Now, Brother Woods, of course, was for benevolent institutions, but not for the missionary society. And he recognized and he saw that in this case of Paul, it was his want. He was the one who took the wages. There was no missionary society involved. Now, it would be interesting to ask Brother Woods how he can get a church in there. If you can't get a, if you can get a church in 2 Corinthians 11, 8 and 9, I can sneak through the same crack with an institution or with a missionary society. But again, recognize that there was cooperation in evangelism, but it was to supply the want and the need of the preacher. It was not to supply the wants of some particular church to go out and do a work to which all these churches are equally and mutually related. Now, let's go to Philippi for just, or to the Philippian letter for just a moment, and look at what Paul said in the fourth chapter, verses 15 and 16. Howbeit, he says, you did well that you had fellowship with my affliction. Verse 14. Then verse 15, and ye yourselves also know, ye Philippians, that in the beginning of the gospel, when I departed from Macedonia, no church had fellowship with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but ye only. For even in Thessalonica, you sent once and again unto my need. So Paul leaves Philippi, goes to Thessalonica, and the Philippian brethren sent once and again to supply Paul's need. Not the church at Thessalonica, but Paul's need. And then Paul said, when I was leaving Macedonia, and there's a key word here, when, which means at the time. At the time Paul was leaving Macedonia to go first of all to Athens, and then secondly on to Corinth, when he was leaving, the Philippian brethren gave and he received funds as he was leaving to support him in his travel, in his preaching, and so forth. Now, sometime later, after he goes to Athens, after he spends some time there, and then he moves over to Corinth, then he says, I robbed other churches, taking wages of them that I might do you service or minister to you here in the church at Corinth. So Philippians 4 is a separate occasion when he was in Thessalonica, and at the time he left Macedonia, then he took wages later down at the church of Corinth. Those are two separate things. Now, the reason I make that point is because there is some convolution, I guess you'd say, going on to try to get a sponsoring church of Philippi for what Paul was doing in Corinth. And the reasoning goes something like this, that the term giving and the term receiving are bookkeeping terms. And they obviously were words that a bookkeeper would use, and no one denies that. So what in fact happened here was that the Philippian church was just keeping the books. And other churches were sending to Philippi, and Philippi was keeping track of what was given and keeping track of what was dispersed, and so therefore they were a sponsoring church for all these other churches that Paul received wages from while he was in Corinth. But two or three things about that I want to make note of. There's several problems with that argument. Of course, number one is just simply assumed without proof that this was a bookkeeping thing here that was going on at Philippi. But first of all, Paul said he received wages from churches at Corinth. Now, if churches are funneling money through Philippi, then Paul would not say Philippi is the only one I had fellowship with. I mean, it makes no sense for Paul to say, well, Philippi is the only one I have fellowship with me, and there's 10 other churches that's funneling money in through Philippi to Paul. And so Paul received wages from churches, not from one church when he was at Corinth. That is, not from one church, Philippi. Paul says at the time of the support from Philippi that no church had fellowship with me. he says in the Philippian passage, except you. You're the only one that had fellowship with me. Well, if other churches are funding money, it seems to me all of them are having fellowship with him. And that's just a misrepresentation if Philippi is indeed a sponsoring church here. And thirdly, as we've already noted, the money that Paul received from Philippi was when, at the time he left Macedonia, which was sometime before he ever got to Corinth. While he was at Thessalonica and when he was leaving Macedonia is when this money came from Philippi. And so that weighs against the idea of Philippi as a sponsoring church. And then the receiving of the funds was by Paul, and the giving of the funds was by Philippi. And that's what the giving and receiving is all about. They were giving funds to him at Thessalonica. They were giving funds to him when he left Macedonia, and he was receiving those funds. And that's the explanation of the terminology that Paul uses there. And so beyond the time at Macedonia and Thessalonica when Philippi was supporting him, beyond that time, Paul received wages from other churches. And so the apostle then clearly is simply stating in Philippians 4 that this is the only church. At the time I was at Thessalonica, at the time I was leaving Macedonia, this is the only church that had fellowship with me. And so later, obviously, other churches did, as 2 Corinthians 11 brings out. Okay. I'll wind up then here, and we can talk further about this. But the controversy, in conclusion, the controversy arose over sponsoring churches because brethren refused to be silent where the Scriptures are silent. And that's why I wanted to make that point at the very beginning, and I want to stress that point again and again and again. Get you a sermon on the silence of the Scripture. If you don't have one, I'll be glad to send you one. But you don't need me for that, I understand. But rejecting that silence authorizes nothing has been the basis for nearly every division among brethren in the Restoration Movement. I don't care if you talk about the Missionary Society, Instrumental Music and Worship, Benevolent Societies, Sponsoring Churches, Church Support of Colleges, Church Support of Recreation and Social Program. All those things have happened because brethren do not respect the fact that silence authorizes nothing. Nothing authorizes nothing. The scriptural basis for when God says nothing, nothing is authorized, is taught from Deuteronomy 4 and 2, Deuteronomy 29, 29, 2 John 9, Hebrews 7, 13 and 14, 2 Chronicles 26, 16 through 13, 23 rather. All of those passages establish the fact that when God says nothing, nothing is authorized. And so, all arguments and debates that have caused division in the Restoration Movement could have been eliminated if brethren had accepted the biblical principle, if any man speak, let him speak as the oracles of God. And if you speak what God has spoken, you won't have anything to say where he has not spoken. And that's the simple, basic restoration principle. And if that's valid, I believe it is, then that's what we got to preach, and that's where every argument has to come and every argument has to end. And so, with that, I end. All right. Okay, thank you so much for your attention. Appreciate it.